So I'm Lee Smolin, and I'm one of the theorists here working on quantum gravity, although I work on also a number of other things. Complex systems, climate, economics, philosophy of physics, foundations of quantum mechanics, particle physics, cosmology. You find is, anyway, I've worked on many different things. Those are some of the things over the last few years. I don't know you. Maybe we could just, no, it would take too long to go around and ask everybody's name. But if you raise your hand to make a comment or a question, then please say your name. Okay, let's do it that way. I don't have an agenda. My understanding is that the purpose of this is to introduce you to some of the research that's going on at Perimeter. And I'm very happy to do that. We have, in my own field, or the field I work on most of the time, which is quantum gravity, we have quite a lot going on here. And we're quite a central place in the world of quantum gravity. So I'm happy to talk about quantum gravity. I'm also happy to talk about some of the other things I mentioned that I work on. I'm happiest if this is interactive. If I didn't come in prepared to give a lecture, I've given lots and lots of lectures in my life, and I can go into lecture mode anytime anybody wants. But I thought that I would let you cue me. Tell me what you're interested in. Why don't people just start asking questions? And then after a while, I'll see if there's something that I can do a little bit more of a structured presentation in. Does that work? I'm not sure what other people have done in this mode. But I also know that Laurent was here, and Laurent talked about quantum gravity, right? So he may not have left anything to say. What did he talk about, actually? Okay.
And then went on to talk of doing with you recently about this, also talking about curved momentum.
Relative locality.
Yeah.
Relative locality is a cool, cool idea. So I'm happy to talk more about that. But he already talked about it. So questions from you? Any kind of questions? Yeah?
Can you talk about shape dynamics?
Talk about?
Shape dynamics.
Okay, I'll put that on my list. More? And what's your name?
Paolo.
Okay. Any other questions? One of the things I can also talk about is what research is like, what science is like. It doesn't have to be all concrete. Presumably many of you, if not all of you, are considering becoming theoretical physicists, yes? Do you want my impression, not knowing you? If you want to become I'll talk first about science and then specialize to theoretical physics. If you want to be a scientist, you have to, and you want to do well, you have to embody two contradictory personality traits. And one of them is that you have to be really respectful because you're being trained to work in a scientific community that is old, that is very well established, that has established ideas, established techniques. You're going to be, why do we do technical things? Why don't we just talk as scientists? Why do we do experiments or, you know, do proofs or calculations? We do these things because most often when we just make things up, we're wrong. We're extremely fallible. We fool ourselves all the time. We fool other people all the time. It's really easy to screw up and make mistakes. And because of that, in any subject area, there's a whole bunch of techniques which are basically one way or another designed to catch mistakes. I mean, that's what experiments are about. Experiments are about checking whether you made a mistake somewhere. most of what calculations are and proof are is because you usually have an idea before you do a calculation or before you do a proof of what you're computing and what you're proving. Whereas, you know, Feynman once said to a group of people I was with, you better have an idea. You don't do a calculation blind. You do a calculation thinking what you know what the answer is. But the reason why you do a calculation, you don't just write the answer down, is that most of the time your guess is wrong. And most of the time you screw up, you make mistakes. So that all these things that you learn are the techniques of science are tools to catch mistakes and to keep you from fooling yourself. And you basically become a professional scientist when you're good enough at these tools of the trade that other people can respect you and trust you, that when you bring something forward to your fellow scientists, it's going to be the result, it's going to be pretty well error checked and pretty responsibly put forward. So the process of becoming a scientist is learning how to be good enough at some set of techniques and good enough at communication to give a convincing case for somebody, for some idea, for some result that fits professional standards. That is, that can survive scrutiny by tough people. And that's why you have to have respect. You have to have a great deal of respect for the tradition you're being trained in and for the community of people who know those techniques. So that's the one thing that you have to embody. At the same time, you have to be totally rebellious because science isn't done. If science was done, you wouldn't be interested and we wouldn't be interested. Or to put it that way, there are areas that no longer are science because they're so well understood that they can pass over to just being subjects for engineering. Not that engineering isn't very creative and interesting, but it's different than science. Science is about the frontier. Science is about what we don't know. And if you're going to think that you can make a contribution to science, you have to be rebellious enough to think that you can do better than your teachers. You have to look at us here, who are your teachers, and say, they're pretty smart, but they messed up. They got something wrong that I can do better. If you don't think that, what are you doing here? Because there are a lot of really smart, well-educated, you know, confident, even arrogant people in science. There's a, you know, why do you think you can make a contribution? You make think you can make a contribution because you believe within yourself that you can bring something to it that's not been brought before. Okay. Which means that you have to be rebellious. That's sort of the spirit of Galileo in science. You have to be able to stand up and say, whatever the authorities say, you know, see, what, is there anybody Italian here? No, no Italians? Si muove, what is it that Galileo said when he was challenged by the Inquisition? Blah, 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 but still it moves, the earth moves. So you have to have that rebellious spirit of Galileo, but you have to channel it through getting really good at the technical part so that you can, when you stand up and say, no, everything before was wrong, this is right, you can do it in a way that gets people's attention and holds people's attention. Okay? So that's my little thing about being a scientist. Now, theoretical physics is in a very, very perilous and interesting state at the moment. Okay, why? And I'm going to talk about the fundamentals of theoretical physics. Okay, so the part which is really about what are the laws of physics and how do we understand them, how do we know them, are they complete, the search for new laws, the search for unification, the search for a better version of quantum mechanics that makes sense, since the version of quantum mechanics we were given doesn't make any sense. How to unify gravity with cosmology, with elementary particle physics, with quantum physics, those kind of questions. These kind of questions have been in a strange state for the last 30 or 40 years because the experiments got behind the theory. There are, in every domain, there's a well-established theory. In particle physics, there's a standard model of particle physics. In quantum theory, is quantum mechanics, general relativity. I'm being a bit redundant. And all of these theories are incomplete. We know they're incomplete, for one thing, because they don't involve each other. And there can't be six different things that are true that don't talk to each other. Because I can invent few domains of phenomena where to understand them, you would need to understand both quantum theory and relativity, for example, and the standard model of particle physics. So the theory is woefully incomplete, but the experiments support those incomplete theories fantastically well. Now, theorists have invented a lot of ways to go beyond the existing theories. In particle physics, it's called going beyond the standard model. In quantum gravity, there's different proposals for unifying quantum theory and relativity, of which loop quantum gravity, spin foam models, string theory, causal dynamical triangulations, causal sets, et cetera. There's a list of them. In quantum theory, there's a bunch of alternatives to quantum theory which have been developed. And the problem is that the experiments, these new theories, have either make no predictions at all for experiments, or they make predictions which are very flexible. That is, what you want from a theory is a hard and fast prediction that's what's called falsifiable. Falsifiable means if the experiment reports something different, then that prediction is just wrong and likely the theory is wrong. Okay. Falsifiable predictions have been few and far between. Much more common have been, well, you might see cosmic strings, but if you don't, maybe they're just a little bit rarer. That kind of stuff. So there hasn't been a good confrontation between theory and experiment for a long time until the last few years. And we're just at the point where we're in several different domains at once, the Large Hadron Collider in particle physics, in quantum gravity, some astronomical experiments that test special and general relativity very well, in cosmology, various studies of the CMB, are just pushing into the realm of beyond where the standard theories can go, where the existing theories can go. Okay. And so far, with a few exceptions, the experiments are turning up nothing. So at the LHC, there's no extra dimensions, there's no black holes, there's no supersymmetric particles. So far, maybe they'll be seen. In Foundations of Quantum Mechanics, there's no phenomena that violates basic 1927 quantum mechanics, in spite of a lot of looking. In cosmology, there's no, in spite of some hopes, there's nothing that disagrees with inflation, which is both the most elegant and the stupidest theory you can imagine. And which it would be hard to violate anyway, because you could, even if you saw something that it doesn't predict, you could just change the initial conditions a little bit and it would predict it. But so it's a much better time to start to become a theoretical physicist than 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Because 10 or 15 years ago, there were no experiments that were relevant. The experiments just kept reproducing the expected thing. Okay. They're just starting to be important experimental results. And so far, those experimental results don't reward the theoretical efforts of the last 25 or 30 years. That is, nobody gets to jump up and down and say, I was right, which means that becoming a theorist now is a great thing, because you can start to be in the first generation that tries to understand what's really going on. And another thing which is obvious and has probably been said to you over and over again, but the record in theoretical physics is that the real breakthroughs and the real revolutions are not always, otherwise I would already have resigned and done something else, been doing something else for my living, but usually done by people your age. Newton was 24, Einstein was 26, Schrodinger was a little older. This is when they did the great thing they're accomplished for. Heisenberg was 22, 23, Dirac was 22. Kepler was 24, 25. Okay, so you guys are even running out of time. Okay, and it's not that, in 1905 there weren't a bunch of older physicists, who understood things a lot better than Einstein did, who should have made the revolutions that Einstein did. A little aside, if you're French, you think the Poincaré did. But if you're not French, you don't. But there's a reason why Einstein, besides the fact that Einstein had an extraordinary character and really encompassed this rebellion that I talked about, together with a great mastery of his subject. Einstein, there's a reason why his freshness and his 20s was able to initiate these big revolutions. Okay. So you're perfectly placed. There are big revolutions needed, and you guys are perfectly placed to do it. So that's my pep talk. Okay. Now, any other question before I go? Yeah. Okay.
And I'm sure there are some people who maybe not remember everything.
I'll get to it. It occurs to me that there is something I could do that I didn't plan to do. Okay. But there is an experiment that is a shocking breakthrough reported about 2 weeks ago, the opera experiment. Have you guys talked about it too much already? Too much? Everyone talks about opera. Okay. Okay, so I won't talk about opera. Okay. So let me start with, yeah? Good, okay. So just to collect the requests, so foundations of quantum mechanics, quantum gravity, shape dynamics, something about the relative locality stuff. Okay. I feel like a sort of comic giving, you give me 5 words and I'll tell you a joke. Okay. Let me start from foundations of quantum mechanics and go in. Okay. And I'll touch on all those things. What do I really believe? Okay. What I really believe is that quantum mechanics is wrong. What I really believe is that quantum mechanics is one of a bunch of theories that are well defined to deal with small parts of the universe. That is, there's a kind of a theory that makes sense if it's applied to a small subsystem of the universe, where you leave outside most of space and time, you leave outside the observer, you leave outside the clocks. Okay? Quantum mechanics is not the only theory in that category. Newtonian mechanics is in that category. Newtonian mechanics makes no sense as a theory of a whole extended to a whole universe. It makes sense as a theory of a small subsystem where you can prepare a system over and over again and do the experiment over and over again and see how the system evolves. So my view is that quantum mechanics is incomplete, and the real question is, what's the correct theory that replaces it? And that real theory should be a theory which is capable of being a theory of the whole system, the whole universe. Because in my view, and I'm, this is part of what I'm going to say about everything, I think one way in which every theory we have is incomplete is that none of them could stand as extended up to the level of the whole universe. All the theories we have are theories, are snapshots, theories of parts of the world, parts of phenomena. Okay. And so what does that mean for quantum mechanics? I think it means that, so I had a view of an idea about what to do about quantum mechanics for a long time. And I beat my head against the wall with a stupid idea for about 25 years and wrote a few papers about it. And finally, about a year ago, just decided this is ridiculous. I have to have a new idea. And I went to a cafe near my house and I sat down and I said, I have to have a new idea about quantum mechanics. This rarely happens, but I had one. This is not to say that it happens. Most of the time I tell myself I want to have a new idea about something, there's a long period of silence. But I had an idea, and my idea is very simple. If the quantum state, the wave function, is not the complete description of an individual system, it's the description of an ensemble. Okay. But where is that ensemble? If I tell you that I have, you know, in this box that I'm holding a hydrogen atom in a 2p state, and I say that 2p state is a description of an ensemble, where is that ensemble? Where are the other elements of that ensemble? Are they just imaginary? Are they just made up? Or do they actually exist somewhere in the universe? Is there actually a real physical ensemble that that state represents? And the idea is, yes, there is. It's the ensemble which consists of all the other hydrogen atoms in the universe in that state, which is going to be a lot, because there's about 10 to the 80 hydrogen atoms in the universe, in the visible universe. So the ensembles could be real. And that then explains why there are not quantum states to describe you or me or this room or our cats, because we're the unique representatives of ourselves in the universe. So that's why we don't obey quantum mechanics, because we're not parts of ensembles of identical systems. So that's my idea, and I and that's what I'm thinking about quantum mechanics these days. I do, and I've forgotten exactly which one is Lucian's.
Well, it's about something, if you want to describe it classically or like that, then it's impossible. You have to describe it in a way.
So I'm going to duck. What's your name, by the way?
Annie.
Annie, okay. I'm going to duck, but I'm going to go home and think about it. Okay. But basically, I mean, because I didn't come here, I don't want to try to present to you my personal formulation of quantum mechanics. It does, under the right conditions, agree with the Schrodinger equation, so there is likely a story to answer your question, but I'm not going to try to do it real time. Okay. Let me come to quantum gravity. Okay, so that's enough about quantum mechanics. Okay. And let me start with the general issue. Okay. The general issue is we have a very good theory of space and time without quantum mechanics, which is general relativity. General relativity embodies some simple basic principles. And I'm going to state what I think are the principles of general relativity. And then my point of view about quantum gravity is that these principles should be respected also by unification of general relativity with quantum mechanics. So those basic principles are what's called background independence. Background independence means that there is nothing in the formulation of the theory that acts, that causes other things to change or to move, that acts on other things, which is not acted back on in itself. Another way to say this is a principle that Einstein formulated, that there should be no things that act that are not acted back on. There should be no non-reciprocal interactions. Einstein's primary example of this is Newton's concept of space. You need to know, in Newton, you need to know what is the geometry of space in order to predict how particles move. Particles move in a fixed geometry of space, but nothing that the particles do ever affects the geometry of space. So the geometry of space acts on matter, but matter does not act back on the geometry of space. Similarly to the properties of time, you have to give time particular properties in Newton. And that goes into Newton's equations. The velocities and accelerations are with respect to a particular time, but nothing that has dynamics in the universe affects the rate of flow of that time. So those things are ruled out by these principles. General relativity realizes that principle because space acts on matter and space-time acts on matter. But the geometry of matter acts back on space. The geometry of matter is also dynamical and is determined by space, by the dynamics of matter. Okay, so general relativity has this principle of background independence. You don't fix something and then work out the dynamics of space-time. There is no general, in general relativity, when you write down the equations for the dynamics of space-time, it's like writing down the equations for a system of particles that are interacting, or for a bunch of computer bits of memory that are talking to each other through a program. Nothing stays fixed. Everything interacts. Okay? And in general relativity, that is embodied. So we call that background independence. A related, and if you want to go, if any of you are philosophically inclined, if you want to read back from that, you should read back to Mach and read back before Mach to Leibniz, and particularly to the, all this goes back to a debate between Leibniz and Newton in the 17th century over the acceptable, what space and time were. Was that a question? No, you can fake it, but you can't.
But what I'm asking is really the exact definition of this notion of...
I'm not giving you the exact definition. I can't, but it's technical. So I'm not giving it to you. Okay? But I will. The technical definition, okay, is that there be a gauge invariance on the configuration of the phase space. And I can go blah, 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 but I already see enough people saying they don't know what gauge invariance means yet that I'm not going to. Come to me later and I can sketch it for you. Okay. But let me give you a, in the context of general relativity, one of the things that it implies is that the geometry of space-time is not, space-time is not described by a geometry on a manifold. So a thing that they say in general relativity textbooks, which is wrong, is that you pick some four-dimensional manifold and you pick a metric, which is a solution of Einstein's equations on it, and that's a space-time. So you pick the Schwarzschild solution and you write down that metric and that's a space-time. Or you pick the Freeman-Robertson-Walker metric and that's a space-time. That's not a space-time. There's an equivalence class of metrics which are related to each other by a principle called diffeomorphisms. A diffeomorphism is the following. Given a manifold, you can map the points of the manifold to itself. In other words, move the points around in any way that has an inverse and is smooth. Smooth means it respects what's differentiable. It takes differentiable functions to differentiable functions. Okay? Any such mapping from a manifold to itself is called a diffeomorphism, and there's an infinite dimensional group of them. That is the invariance group of general relativity. That is, under this invariance group, the points of a manifold move around. You can't say in general relativity what's the gravitational field at a point or what's the electric field at some point, because points have no meaning. Points are taken to other points and other points and other points and other points by this symmetry operation. The only thing that is meaningful physically in general relativity is what's preserved under moving around what the points are. And what's preserved are things like there was a coincidence of light rays at this point. And those coincidence of light rays, when you move everything, they stay a coincidence of light rays. Okay. Or there was an event in the history of the universe where they looked out and took a picture of the sky, and the sky looked exactly like this. And that's the unique moment and place in the history of the universe where their sky looked exactly like that. Those are those kind of things are physically meaningful. Nothing in terms of points, coordinates, fields is physically meaningful. Yes?
Hi, my name is Richard. Is it true that if we consider only equivalent places of metrics, but we cannot distinguish from, for example, Minkowski space and Minkowski space with some perturbations of metric? So
you can distinguish some, but not others. Then the question begins, yes. Some perturbations are just wiggling the points, and some perturbations are real gravitational waves that carry energy. And to tell the difference, you have to compute something that is physically meaningful, for example, that measures the energy that would be flowing through a barrier or flowing out to infinity. So it becomes a subtle question. Is that a gravitational wave, or is that just the coordinates wiggling? Okay, and there's subtleties. Now, here's my point. My point is that these are principles of general relativity. What Einstein did when he made general relativity was not just invent some equations for the gravitational field. He made a radically different theory of what space and time are. He realized the idea that space and time don't exist as a background. They're not there to hang things on. Space and time are networks of relationships of things that really exist and things that really happen in the world. And that's all that space and time are. Apart from a history where things happen, apart from the causal relations or the other kinds of relations amongst the things that happen in the world, there is no space-time. And this philosophy, which was enunciated going way back before Einstein, was realized in concrete and precise mathematical form by Einstein in this notion of diffeomorphism, invariance, or background independence. And if you want to understand space-time, you should start with general relativity and understand it really well. Okay. Then, if you want to merge quantum mechanics with general relativity, my view, other people disagree, and of course, since we don't have any convincing experimental evidence, you can disagree, but my view is that this revolution in the concept of what space-time is will go along into quantum theory. So that the approaches to quantum gravity, which are on the table, fall roughly into two classes. Those that respect these principles, which we call background independent approaches to quantum gravity, and those that don't. And my view is that those that don't can't succeed. And I have philosophical reasons for that and technical reasons for that. Or if they do succeed, as in, for example, the hope for string theory, it is by being rewritten in a form which is background independent, which, however, has not, I've spent, and a lot of people have spent a lot of time trying to do and has not succeeded. But so that's the first thing. And why do I think it's important to have your head screwed on right philosophically? I mean, why don't you come back to me and talk about, calculations and things like that? Okay. Because it's like David Finkelstein, who was one of my heroes, said when I asked him the same question, it was about the same state. Actually, I was younger. I was an undergraduate, first year undergraduate when I met him. And he talked a lot of blah, blah about philosophy and Leibniz and Mach and so forth. And I said, why are you telling me all these things? Why don't you just compute something? And he said, if I know something about the history of thought, about what I'm thinking about, then it's like having a running start. I'm not trying to jump over a bar just starting from standing still. And I think that that's true. There's a history of attempting to understand what space and time are. And I think it's integrable. It's an integral part of, if you know that history, you can understand all that's going on in the technical calculations in light of those issues raised by that history. So that's why I raise it for you. So among the background independent approaches, so I'll stick to those for a while. There are several. Loop quantum gravity is the one that's been best developed, been best worked on. And I'm happy to talk about it, but there are others. One, which is called causal dynamical triangulations, is also pretty, to me, pretty impressive, pretty interesting. There are some others which are newer. There's something called quantum graffiti or quantum graffiti, which I think is pretty interesting. There's an older one called causal sets that I'm pretty disappointed in. But let me tell you maybe a little bit about loop quantum gravity, since that's the one I know best, and that's the one that's best developed. Okay. So of all of these, loop quantum gravity is the one that is the most conservative in its formulation. It's conservative because it comes from taking general relativity, formulated in an intelligent manner, and quantum mechanics, and simply putting them together. And out comes loop quantum gravity. So it's actually not true if you hear, it's commonly said, there is no quantum theory of gravity, or you can't quantize the Einstein equations. Yes, you can. It's been done. We don't know that the theory that results is right, but the theory, there is a very well-defined theory that results. Okay? Now, what do I mean by formulate general relativity in an intelligent manner? General relativity is a theory of how to make measurements in space-time and how those measurements evolve dynamically. There are two critical inputs to general relativity. There's the metric. Have you guys had some general relativity? Okay. That's right, you're even having a course. There's the metric, which tells you how to measure distances and lengths and volumes and things like that. And then there's the connection, which tells you how to parallel transport things around. Have you been introduced to the connection? Okay. Did Neil emphasize that originally the metric and the connection are completely independent objects? Right. Okay. Now, the dumb way to understand general relativity from the point of view of quantum mechanics is to take the point of view that the metric is the fundamental field and the connection is a slave to the metric, which is the way that general relativity is usually taught. The connection is the Christoffel connection, which is made of derivatives of the metric. Okay. The more intelligent way, and I'll tell you in a minute why it's the more intelligent way, is to take the connection as the main story. Why is that, and to take the metric as a kind of auxiliary field. Why is that the more intelligent way? I'll give you two reasons. One of them is that it leads to the simplest possible form of writing the equations. Now, general relativity is a nonlinear theory, but by changing variables, you can simplify the nonlinearity. You can't linearize it, because that would be to have no interactions. You can't take nonlinear differential equations and make them linear. But you can make them as least linear as possible. And what's as least linear as possible is quadratic equations. Okay. So if you take the connection as the fundamental variable and postpone any relation between the connection and the metric, you can write all the equations of general relativity as quadratic equations. There are more equations, but they're much simpler. They're just simple quadratic equations. And the action principle is just a cubic equation. Okay. So you never have to talk about the inverse of the metric. You never have to compute its determinant. You never have to talk about 1 over the square root of the determinant. There's just some quantities within which it's just a quadratic equation. So that's one reason that's smart. The second reason is that in the rest of fundamental physics, namely the standard model, electromagnetism and weak interactions, QCD, the connection is the main story. The connection is like the vector potential in electrodynamics. The field strength is a slave to the connection in two ways. The magnetic fields are the curls of the vector potential, so they're just simple derivatives of it. Okay? And the electric fields are the momenta conjugate to the vector potential. That's really the right way to understand the momentum, the momenta. The electric field. They're the momenta conjugate to the connection. So it turns out, in this right way to think about general relativity, the metric turns out to be the momentum conjugate to the connection. So it's really like an electric field. Okay. Now, then you can. So writing it that way, there are some names associated with that. Amitabha Sen, Abhay Ashtekar, Fibansky, there's some other people who developed it as well. But there's a whole intelligent classical way to understand general relativity. Okay. Once you formulate it that way, you can use a language of quantization which is very close to that of Yang-Mills theory in electromagnetism. And here's the basic physical idea, which is what started us on this path. Okay? So you know about, if you have a superconductor, then the flux of a magnetic field is quantized. The flux lines of a magnetic field in a superconductor become discrete. And there's some quanta flux that I won't remember, but it's written down in terms of the electric charge in H bar, right? There's some quanta of magnetic flux. If you measure the magnetic flux in a superconductor across a surface, it's some integral amount of that flux. Now, one of the original ideas about the strong interactions, which predates QCD but which QCD realizes, is that hadrons would be dual superconductors. that is electric, there would be a kind of a new kind of electric field, which is the QCD field, whose electric flux is quantized in empty space, dual to the magnetic flux of a superconductor being quantized, coming in discrete units. And so the idea is in QCD, the electric flux is quantized and forms strings. And the quarks sit at the end of those strings. And those are those pictures you may have seen of, say, a meson with a quark, a string of electric flux, and an antiquark at the other end. Or a proton, which is three quarks and a string. Each one, a string comes in, and then the string is tied together at a vertex at the middle. Okay. So this electric field flux quantized picture of QCD inspires the idea of confinement. That's why you can't ever get a free quark, because you stretch these electric flux lines and it costs you energy per unit length to stretch the electric flux lines. Okay. This is also the idea behind string theory. String theory was an attempt to make a dynamics for the quantized lines of electric field flux. That's where it really comes from. And that's what the ADS-CFT correspondent says, finally, you can achieve. Okay. Now, the idea of loop quantum gravity is, if you have general relativity formulated in a language like Yang-Mills theory, then maybe the analog of electric field flux is quantized. And the analog of electric field flux turns out to be area. So it turns out, when you quantize general relativity in this language and you calculate what could the area of a surface be, you define a surface in some invariant physical way and you ask what's its area, and you come up with a formula in terms of integral units of some charges and its electric field flux. So that here's the area, and here's a quantum state, which is some lines of electric field flux piercing the surface, and each one comes with a certain little quanta of area. Just like in superconductors, each flux line of a magnetic field comes with a certain amount of magnetic flux. So area equals h bar g times electric flux. Is a result that you get by quantizing general relativity in that language. Okay. And then, well, there could be nodes where these lines begin and end. And then there's a beautiful result that if you have a region and you want to know what's the volume of the region, it's h bar g to the 3/2, that gives you a volume, times the number of nodes. This is actually a simplification of the formula, but that's good enough. So that volume of space is measured by the number of nodes of the quantized electric field flux. So that's the basic picture that emerged from taking seriously this dual superconductor picture, and taking Ashtekar's way of writing general relativity in a smart way. Okay. So what you imagine is that a quantum state of the gravitational field is a big complex network. This is a quantum geometry. The complex network has quanta of volume associated with nodes and quantas of areas associated with edges. And that's how geometry of space is coded quantum mechanically. Yes? Yes, so the way you get background independence is these things don't have coordinates. It doesn't matter where they are. This is just a network of relationships. You don't say, you know, where, if I take this and I erase it and I move the node over, that's implementing a diffeomorphism invariance. It's the same quantum state. The quantum state is invariant under diffeomorphism. It's invariant under how you draw. But just, oh, very, very good, because I have to tell you what the volume of. So one thing I can do is I can tell you the volume of all of space. And then that's invariant. Space might be, for example, a compact three-dimensional sphere. And then it makes sense to say, what's the volume of space? If I want to tell you the volume of a smaller region, you're absolutely right. I have to define that smaller region. Here's a way to do it. I can couple to a scalar field. Okay? And now I imagine the region where that scalar field is less than zero. So I'm going to shade everywhere in space a region where the scalar field is less than zero. That's physically well defined. If I make a diffeomorphism, the scalar field moves with the network. And then I can ask, what's the volume of the region where the scalar field is less than zero? Okay, so does everybody get the basic picture? Okay, now, yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that space-time itself is discrete. You have the volume of some region.
What do you mean by space-time itself?
Not sure.
So first of all, I've been telling you about spatial geometry, not space-time geometry. Okay? And I've been talking about observables, but not space-time observables, but spatial observables. So your point is well taken. Okay. Now, to ask about whether there's some physical discreteness, you have to find a way to construct observables that refer to real physical objects and events that live in space-time. So one way to do that is to talk about the space-time, the quantum space-time of a black hole, which has a black hole horizon. So I can define a surface in the space-time by some geometrical properties that black hole horizons have. And I can construct operators that live on those surfaces. And then it'd say, for any way of slicing it, so I have some two-sphere, that circle grows up into a two-sphere, okay, which is a section through the horizon of the black hole. Can I construct an operator that measures its geometry, its area and other aspects of its geometry? And are those operators having discrete spectra? And that can be done, and the answer is yes. So there's a whole framework for studying black holes which was developed over the last 15 years or so, which allows, in those cases, for the study of properties of black hole horizons to be studied. Yes?
Related to Wayne's mark, related to black holes, do you have anything about constant radiation? Can you say anything about it?
Yes. So first of all, the entropy of these horizons can be computed and is proportional to the area. Okay, there's an extra constant in this way of seeing gravity. There's an additional coupling constant called the Immerse parameter, which actually measures parity odd effects, measures the possibility that gravitational physics breaks parity. Okay, and that constant comes into the calculation of the entropy of a black hole, and to get the 1/4 from Hawking, you have to fix that constant to a certain value. Okay. So that's not as great a result as we'd like, because we'd like to know why that's true. And there are some arguments and discussions about that, and there's a whole history of that trying to understand why the Immerse parameter has that value. But that's the honest statement. Now, as far as Hawking radiation, yes, there are models of Hawking radiation, and particularly because the area is discrete and has a discrete spectrum, and the mass of a black hole is related to its area, which means the Hamiltonian that measures the energy of a black hole is related to the area. So it means that the actual radiation is discrete, just like an atom gives out spectral lines because they're discrete stationary states. A black hole has spectral lines. And that has been computed. The envelope looks like the Hawking thermal spectrum, but there's a bunch of lines under the envelope. So there's enhancement of a discrete set of lines. This was work done by a group just of students in Valencia, Spain, and also by a graduate student here, Mohammed Ansari. This is now 3 or 4 years ago. So if we happen to see an evaporating, like a mini black hole in the last stages of evaporating, so all this is in the X-ray, there's a definitive prediction for what the fine structure should be. And that's checkable. That's falsifiable. So there is something about Hawking, so that's what's known about Hawking radiation. Yeah. Yeah, what's your name?
Manya.
So I didn't say it, but let me say it. But when you get the structure from quantizing general relativity, there's no classical three-dimensional geometry, but there's a classical three-dimensional topology, which is fixed and not dynamical. Because in general relativity, you have to fix the topology of space. It's fixed. It's one aspect of the theory that's not dynamical. And once you fix the topology of space, yes, there could be knots. There could be edges that knot. There could be sets of edges that braid. And I used to be able to draw these things over, under. Well, that'll do. That's a braid. There can be braids, there can be knots, there can be all kinds of complicated tangles. And it's a very interesting question, are there any physical observables associated with these? So one idea which has been studied, and mostly here, is that these are elementary particles. That this is how elementary particles, like the fermions, are coded in and arise out of the quantum geometry. And I would say that we've had incomplete success with that idea. There's a beautiful little story that starts with a paper of Sundance, Bilson Thompson, that connects the simplest types of braids to the structure of the quarks and the leptons and the vector bosons. And that can be coded into these states in loop quantum gravity. But after 3 or 4 years, we don't see a beautiful way that the dynamics of the elementary particles comes out. But it's a natural idea. I mean, the idea that matter has to do with the topology of space and geometry is a very old idea. And so it can be realized here. But now, a thing that I didn't say, but let me just say to complete the picture. I didn't mention anything about dynamics, but of course, physics is about dynamics. So how do these states evolve in time? So how they evolve in time is that these nodes change under local moves. So there's a set of moves. For example, a piece of a diagram like that could change to that, or a node could have a triangle grow up inside of it. And you could imagine that there's a history of these graphs where they change at events where one of these moves happens. And each time it happens, there's a quantum amplitude. And then you describe a history by a sequence of such moves. Each one gets a quantum amplitude. You multiply them together, and that's the quantum amplitude of the whole history. And then you implement Feynman's sum over history's quantization. And that's called the spin-foam model. And that's where much of the technical work is, in working out the details of the predictions of such models. And that's sort of where the cutting edge of the dynamics is. So for example, you want to know if you derive the amplitudes for the moves from some quantization procedure, which you can do, following some rules, that's good. Can you go backwards? That is, given the quantum dynamics, can you derive the classical dynamics, that is, the dynamics of general relativity, as an approximation to the quantum dynamics when you're looking at a suitably large scale? And that's where the focus of much of the technical work is in the field. And Laurent and colleagues, I'm not so much involved with that, but Laurent, Razvan, many of the postdocs here are involved in that. And it's looking pretty, it's looking, as the last 3 years, more positive than it did, say, 10 years ago. Now, the part that I'm more involved with, see, about 10 years ago, I started to worry a lot that, and I was mostly working on string theory then, and I start to worry a lot about the problem of experiment and how you would experimentally test any quantum theory of gravity. And I realized, and really following some younger, smarter people, that there would be experiments over the next 10 years, and this is from 10 years ago, that really could measure quantum gravity effects. And so I got very interested, and a lot of my work since then is about tests. And if I have your attention for 5 minutes, maybe nobody's interested in this, but I can sort of indicate. Okay, so. So just dimensionally, quantum gravity has G, H bar, C, the cosmological constant, maybe some other constants. Where are we going to find experimental tests of quantum gravity? Okay. Well, so one way which has emerged is very promising is to ask what happens to the symmetries of special relativity. So in special relativity, you have Lorentz invariance. And you could ask, supposing you do experiments at a scale where you can see things dependent on these parameters. For example, the Planck mass, and I'm setting C equal to 1 everywhere. Planck mass is the square root of h bar over g, and is, as you know, 10 to the 19 JeV. The Planck length is the square root of h bar g, is about 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. Okay. So it's pretty difficult to probe down to the Planck length. Okay. But here's something you can do. You can look for phenomena which involve energies over the Planck mass. That's usually going to be a small number. But you can look for amplifiers of small numbers. And let me give you an example. Okay. Supposing that Lorentz invariance, supposing that special relativity were not true. Supposing special relativity were not true at a level of energies over the Planck mass. Okay. Where would that show up? So now what you should do is take in your head every fact from special relativity and every equation and add corrections of this order. Does anybody want to make a proposal? Yeah? Yeah. So for example, let's say that the speed of light depends on energy, and it looks like C times 1 plus a constant alpha energy over M Planck, plus maybe smaller effects. Okay. Could that be seen? Okay. Well, we see gamma rays that come from cosmological distances away. So we're interested in a delta time of arrival over t, which is going to go like delta v over c, which is going to go like E over M Planck. Okay? If I change the speed of light by a little bit, I change the arrival time by an amount proportional to the time. Okay? So I'm interested in delta t on the order of E over M Planck times some travel time. Okay? Supposing I put in 10 JeV here. This is 10 to the minus 18. Okay. But t is like 10 to the 18 seconds, 10 to the 17 seconds. So this is order 1 second. So is a second in difference in arrival time for a gamma ray burst meaningful if, say, the bluer the more energetic photons arrive a second different than the less energetic photons? Oh, yeah. Because gamma ray bursts only last from a tenth of a second to a few seconds. So if this effect is there, I had my little constant alpha here. If this effect is here at order 1, then the spectrum, the patterns of arrival of photons and gamma ray bursts would be distorted. If you think more energetic photons go faster, then a gamma ray burst should start off with a few photons with 10, 20, 30 GeV, and then you should see the lighter photons a second or so later. Okay? But that doesn't happen. Okay? So in fact, from experiments, from current experiments, which are gotten from the Fermi satellite, alpha is now less than about 0.8. So we are absolutely at the quantum gravity scale. Actually, it's alpha is less than 0.8 for subliminal. Because it's actually harder to know whether the more energetic photons come later. We're pretty sure that the more energetic photons are not delayed. They're not slowing down by an alpha. For a superluminal, it's less good. It's less than maybe something in the 100 for superluminal. I forget. I wrote a paper about this, but I don't remember the number. Okay, so that's the situation. So moreover, well, I could go on, but I think the point is made. There are a bunch of different experiments that test special relativity to very high accuracy, and so far it's holding up. Just to mention another one, have you all heard about the GZK process? Okay. So cosmic rays are believed to be mostly protons, and there's a spectrum of cosmic rays that travel that have very, very high energies, up to 10 to the 19, 10 to the 20, 10 to the 21 electron volts, which is to say E over M Planck of about a billion. Okay. And there's an old prediction due to GZ and K, whose names I won't remember, from the early 1960s, that at a certain energy, these protons will scatter off of the photons in the microwave background, produce electron-positron pairs or pions, and lose energy. So the prediction was that the spectrum of cosmic rays at about 3 times 10 to the 19 electron volts should basically cut off. Because the universe becomes opaque to cosmic rays because of this process. Now, this process turns out to test special relativity very, very precisely. It tests special relativity to a gamma of about 10 to the 11. You know, gamma is the 1 over square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. Okay. If special relativity were wrong at that gamma, it might keep falling. And the last 2 or 3 years, there's good evidence at the Auger Cosmic Ray Observatory that they're seeing the cutoff. There's an even more interesting story, which is controversial. The more interesting story is that there is, in the statistics, there are some events over the cutoff. So how could that be if they're losing energy? That could be if they come from close enough away that they're within the mean free path. They haven't had time to lose energy yet. Because you have to remember, in their frame of reference, which differs from ours by a factor of 10 to the 11, they're not traveling for 100 million years. They're traveling, well, somebody can work it out, for less than an hour or something like that. So they could come from a nearby galaxy and have time to get here before they lose energy. And indeed, there's a good correlation between where these guys come from in the sky, the ones that are over the cutoff, and active galactic nuclei, which are believed to be centers of black holes, of galaxies with big black holes in it, which could be origin or good sources of very energetic cosmic rays. Now, this data is a little bit controversial, but there is a decent correlation. There's not as good a correlation as people wanted there to be, but there's a correlation. Okay. So again, we're testing quantum gravity in the guise of testing special relativity up to terms of order energy over the Planck mass. So that's why quantum gravity is now an experimental subject. Okay. Now, one more word and I'll close. Lorentz invariance could be broken in the way that I've been describing. I've been assuming that there's just a preferred frame of reference. But it turns out that special relativity can be modified in ways that change all the equations by these kinds of terms while keeping the relativity of inertial frames. And such ideas are called deformed or sometimes doubly special relativity. And they're about 10 years old. And so there are really three possibilities for what's the fate of special relativity in the more correct theory of quantum gravity. It could be just true. It could be broken, so there's a preferred frame of reference. And, you know, Galileo was wrong, Newton was wrong, Aristotle was really right. Or it could be deformed so that all those guys were right. There is no preferred frame of reference, but still, when you get up to the quantum gravity scale, you begin to see new effects that are not taken into account in special relativity. And most of my work, and the work that Laurent may have told you about under the name of relative locality is a smart way of understanding this idea that special relativity is modified. Okay, more questions? I don't know how long you guys want me to talk, but I'm yes?
So I didn't quite follow why it's either or. So I got that it was either that there's a preferred reference frame or you can modify special relativity.
Or special relativity might just be right.
Okay.
Which is hard for me to imagine. But that is, it's hard for me to imagine it doesn't break somewhere. I mean, do you really think that there's an observer who sees a length contraction that would contract a whole galaxy down to the size of an atom? You know, I mean, 10 to the minus 11 is still, I mean, that's a length contraction, you know, that takes a centimeter down well inside an atomic diameter, you know, almost to the nucleus. So it's amazing that we go that far, but you really think we go all the way down to the Planck scale? On the other hand, this kind of experimental check, I mean, 10 years ago, these numbers were three orders of magnitude different. And a lot of people were willing to bet that special relativity would just turn out to be wrong and would just break down. And that doesn't seem to be what's happening. What's happening is that we get, you know, we're sort of up to the boundary of the Planck scale, and, but special relativity is holding up very well. Okay, you had a question?
What kind of complex systems? I know you've done something with economics and stuff. You see it, but
I started thinking about the uses of biology in cosmology. In particular, when I understood that there was a landscape problem in string theory, which was 1986, I started to worry about whether, why if the laws of nature are selected out of a big, big class of laws of nature, the ones that are selected lead to a universe that has so much complexity and structure. The question that's usually mislabeled under the anthropic issue, why is it that there are long-lived stars that are stable? Why is it that there's 100 stable nuclei, there's carbon chemistry? Why there's all this complexity on a whole scale of length scales in a universe just constructed from the laws of physics? If given typical laws of the gauge theory kind and typical parameters, we would just have, you know, boring gas, you know, clouds of gas. So I started to worry about that. And I started to study biology and evolutionary theory, because evolutionary theory was the only context I knew of where an answer for how complex systems evolve according to natural processes was answered. And so then I happened to invent this scenario for how universes could evolve analogous to populations of living creatures. And that's called cosmological natural selection, even makes a few predictions, which even have held up to this day. This is 20 something years later. So I got interested in that. And that got me interested in theoretical biology. And I also started to get interested. So my little theory predicted that there should be as many black holes as possible. And I started to try to calculate how many black holes a galaxy would produce in its lifetime, and I realized that that was governed by all sorts of feedback effects and nonlinear effects. As a galaxy is not just a dead thing, a galaxy is full of feedback, nonlinear feedback systems at different scales, driving or suppressing star formation. This is why galaxies have patterns. That's why they look spirals, why they have various structure and patterns, is that they're far from equilibrium systems driven by competing feedbacks on different scales. So I started to try to understand that. And at that time, I'd written a book about that kind of stuff. And one of the reviewers of the book was a very influential theoretical biologist, Stu Kaufman. And he showed me some models where I could understand the complex structure of galaxies in terms of models that were used in embryology called reaction diffusion models. So I wrote some papers about that. That was pretty fascinating, applying models from embryology into the feedback effects governing star formation. And then as a result, I got invited out to the Santa Fe Institute, which at that time was an institute devoted to the structure of complex systems. And I thought, if they're helping me with my stuff, okay, I'll try to jump in and collaborate with them. And there was a group working on the origin of life, so I started to get involved a little bit in the origin of life, which I had, you know, and this is typical of my pattern in these kind of studies. I got interested, I read a lot, I talk with people, I have a lot of fun, I have an idea, I write a paper, and then I realized the problem is really hard. And so I wrote one paper on the origin of life, and Then I started to talk to experimentalists about what would be necessary to test the hypothesis that the paper was based on, which had to do with interactions of membranes and amino acids. And then I understood how hard it really was, that I was, you know, not doing remotely what was necessary. And so that's how I started to get involved in complex systems. I mean, ultimately, I think the the idea that the laws of nature, the hyper-reductionist idea that the laws of nature just are in some absolute sense, and then this biology and chemistry over here just happen to be possible, I think that's very incomplete. And the reason is that the reductionist thing works when you're breaking things down to pieces and understanding how something like a molecule works in terms of the properties of its atoms. But then you get to the elementary particles and you want to know, why do they have the particular masses and charges they do? And there's no explanation. We still have no explanation for why the parameters of the Standard Model are what they are. So maybe it has something to do with the fact that with these choices of parameters, we get complex chemistry and many kinds of nuclei and nuclear reactions and stars and so forth. Okay. And then there's this dumb idea and the smart idea. The dumb idea is the anthropic principle, and I don't mind calling it that way. It's way overrated. Okay. It's just taking a mystery about science and turning it around and stating it as if it were a profound philosophical realization, when in fact all you're doing is restating a scientific question that you have not answered. And the smart way is to look for real dynamical coupling between processes that give rise to the parameters having those values and their consequences. For example, that they're long-lived stars. And that requires taking seriously that all the different scales influence each other. It's not just the small scales are sacred and just are unchanging and there for some absolute reason, and then the large scales just come along for the ride. I mean, the universe gets reprocessed, to use Johnny Wheeler's word. From time to time, it goes through a singularity. Singularity bounces, it gets reborn. And all the scales get squeezed together at that point. So something dynamical and physical is happening to couple all the different scales together. And so I think that complex systems is part of fundamental physics. That is, it matters to know what the mass and the charge of the electron are, ultimately depend on what kind of complex systems get made. And then the other things just followed, because once I hung around Santa Fe, opportunities came up to get involved in the economics thing came up because somebody who had been a big guy in the financial world around 2007 was going around the country or North America trying to put together a collaboration of people that he thought to tackle the economic crisis that he believed would happen a year later. So he came and took me out for dinner in Toronto and said, look, the investment banks all have cancer. Something really bad is going to happen. He wants to pull together a group of people to try to find some intelligent way to model markets and economies. And what am I willing to help? So then that's another instance in which I got involved. I learned a lot. I had a lot of interesting conversations. We had a conference here. I wrote a paper. And then I understood the problem was really hard. So, but for what it's worth, if somebody wanted to, against all difficulty, make a real theory of economics, they would have to make it as a gauge theory. That is, it would use the notion of a gauge connection, use the same mathematics that general relativity and Yang-Mills theory works. Because as soon as you get out of, quote, equilibrium in economics and things become path-dependent, then you have to measure path-dependent. You have to measure the cost between the economy evolving one way versus another way, or the cost between doing a cycle of trades one way and another way, which in standard economics, it's a principle that it can't matter what order you do trades in because the market knows everything. But of course, it does matter. That's why investment banks make money on currency trades. And if you want to understand why investment banks do make money consistently on currency trades, it's because markets are path dependent. And if you want to measure path dependence, that's called curvature. And the mathematics that's involved is the mathematics of connections and curvatures. And that's the easy part. And the easy part is also, if you're inclined, modeling markets well enough, doing that to get you hired by a hedge fund, which is what happened to one of the postdocs that was involved in this project. The hard problem is convincing mainstream economists that this is worth talking about. It's not the scientific problem. It's actually getting through to these people. Okay, another question.
Yeah,
At least that's when I got out of it. Yeah. That can be your paper. No, I really don't recommend going into economics. I really do not recommend going into economics. But let me use the thing as a kind of moral. There's something that Harold Morowitz was a kind of hero and mentor of mine. You've probably never heard of him, but he's a theoretical chemist, biologist. He's worked a lot on the origin of life. And I met him when I was an undergraduate. And he said, look, there are two kinds of scientists. There are scientists who, in graduate school, they pick a subject, they learn a method, they study the method, and they've come out of graduate school with a method, and they go around and apply it to problems. Okay. And then the other kind of scientist is the scientists who have questions and start with questions and think about questions. And when they need a method, they go and teach themselves the method they need to know. And the moral of the story is that in the first kind, where sometimes there's some very smart people, but their careers tend to look like that. That is because at some point, you've solved all the problems that can be solved with the method that you learned in graduate school. And if your motivation was being the smartest person who used that method, you're done. You might be, but you still have nothing, you still stall. If you go into science because you're curious and you want to discover things about the world, then you're always asking more questions. And what you'd need is the skill and the confidence that when you need a method, you can master it well enough that you can use it to advance an idea and study an idea. And so if you take that attitude in the long term, because life lasts a long time, you can have a career where you work on bunches of different things. And I think in the long run, that at least for me, that's paid. As I've always, I've been working on thinking about quantum gravity since I was 17 and focused on it. And it's still the main core that I'm focused on. Even when I'm not thinking about these stupid neutrinos, which must be wrong, which is my current obsession. But the fact that I could jump into cosmology or foundations of quantum mechanics or theoretical biology or economics is because I know how to teach myself enough to get started in something. And some of that is just is confidence, and some of it, which I learned later, was learning how to collaborate. This is learning how to work with people who know different things. And learning what questions to ask when you're in a collaboration. Okay. Any more last questions? Okay. Well, I didn't talk as much about quantum gravity as probably you expected, but yes?
What's the relationship between these bounds and this field?
You know, at the root, did everybody hear her question? Okay, the question is, what's the relationship between these knots or loop quantum gravity and string theory? At the root, string theory and loop quantum gravity come from the same idea. The idea is, which was the idea of the dual superconductor picture that I talked about. The dual superconductor picture says if you have a gauge connection and you quantize it, the states of the quantum theory, okay, can be described in terms of excitations of lines of force. Quantized electric flux are just lines of force. They're Faraday's lines of force quantized. And if you have lines of force which relate to a vector potential, you can study the quantum mechanics of the vector potential, or you can study the quantum mechanics of the lines of force. That is, give these quantum dynamics, wiggle them, move them around, interact them. Okay? And the idea that gave rise to string theory, it was an idea of Polyakov, Migdal, some others, Mandelstam, was that you could quantize a gauge theory by modeling and quantizing the quantized lines of force. Okay. Now, if you do that in a fixed background, So if you say that these strings live in a fixed space-time geometry, then you're giving laws for the strings to move in a fixed space-time geometry, and that's string theory. You can do it on different space-time geometry backgrounds. They have to satisfy the Einstein equations plus some corrections. But you're giving completely separate the geometry and the quantum strings. So that's why we call that a background-dependent approach. If you take the same idea and you quantize the lines of force, not on a background, but as the fundamental degrees of freedom of the geometry, of the quantum geometry, you're asking the same question without the approximation of seeing the lines of force on the classical space-time background. And then you're doing loop quantum gravity. So I've thought for a long time that they were the same thing in different language. That's been my belief for a long time. The technical details start to look very different. In string theory, you need for consistency higher number of dimensions. You need for consistency supersymmetry. So far as we know, we don't need those here, although we can have them. There's no obstacle to study. And in recent work, there's some very good work. And what's been going on for years, but recently there's some very good work in Germany about higher dimensions and supersymmetry and so forth. So it's an option here you can have, but in the string approach, it seems essential. Whether, you know, so I've spent a lot of time on trying to join them. And in fact, it's even deeper than that. The work that became loop quantum gravity started off as an attempt to make a background independent string theory. It just then turned out to be easier to do an example. You know, quantizing general relativity with that technique turned out to be an example. That so at least when I started, they were the same. They were intimately related. They were the same thing. Now, as research communities, they're different. Although we talk to each other, the dynamics is very different. The styles is very different. But fundamentally, we're all physicists. To me, I've become less interested in the program of trying to show that they're the same thing. But I think that, you know, if somebody were interested in that, I would be able to suggest some things. I'm much more interested in what's the right thing. That is, I'm not doctrinaire about anything. I'm doctrinaire about how I started this discussion. I'm doctrinaire about background independence and diffeomorphism invariance. I'm doctrinaire that physics is relational, which is Leibniz's word in his debates with Newton. Physics is about dynamical relationships evolving. It's not about things living in a background space and time. Those are my principles that I believe in. Whether the right thing is going to look more like loop quantum gravity or more like string theory, it doesn't keep me up at night. I personally think that the last 10 years, loop quantum gravity has made a lot more progress towards the fundamental things that it has to do to become really a real predictive theory. But that's, you know, that's just my point of view. A very good thing about perimeter, and we were set up this way, is that there are both here. And not only, and there's not just loop quantum gravity and string theory, but there are other approaches. The causal set approach, which is led by Raphael Sorkin, is here. Causal dynamical triangulations, Renata Lowell, who probably will teach the quantum gravity course in December, is the inventor of the causal dynamical triangulations program. This program, Quantum Graffiti, is the program of Fotini-Marcopulo. So we have lots of different, I wouldn't say lots, we have a bunch of different approaches to quantum gravity all going on under this roof, including loop quantum gravity and string theory. And we talk to each other. I mean, and we're constructive. Sometimes we go to each other's group meetings, sometimes we don't. But there certainly are people doing both in this building. So for example, you guys probably know Nima. The Ferber. Yeah. So Nima, yeah, everybody knows Nima. Nima, And that, so Nima is a student in both areas. Okay, other question? Yeah.
This idea about the matter as some psychological effects, how far can one go in this direction? Is it part of what loop gravity or how?
Within loop gravity, you can go, how far can you go? 4 years ago, we were ecstatic about it. So there's a little game where you can take braids, three-stranded braids like this, and you can code by different ways of braiding and twisting, you can code the standard model of particle physics. And there's a very cute little calculus of how that works, which was discovered by Sundance Bilson Thompson. And that can be coded right into loop quantum gravity. What doesn't work, well, I'll tell you what works and what doesn't work. What works is the identities of the particles are preserved as long as you just have graphs with nodes with three edges. Then the identities of the different particle states are preserved. So when the quantum geometry evolves, a neutrino, a left-handed muon neutrino stays a left-handed muon neutrino. A right-up red quark stays a right-up red quark, and so forth. Okay, that's good. Okay. What's bad is that the identities of the particles stay preserved under the interactions of the quantum gravitational field, because that means there's no interactions. There's no weak, strong, or electromagnetic interactions. It's as if they've been turned off. Okay. What's also bad is that the theory of quantum gravity said there should be geometries with nodes with any number of edges. So then we start playing games with nodes with any number of edges, and then things just become so complicated and just we weren't able to unravel, to use a metaphor. That. So it's a promising idea, but it needs another promising idea to go somewhere. Okay, should we finish? Let me just close by saying that I'm certainly happy to talk to anybody. You are very, 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 everybody's very invited to the group meetings, which are Thursdays at 2:30 to 4. So starting tomorrow, they're in the Sky Room. We're gonna organize them. You may have been getting emails from Cecilia. Do you get the PI researchers' emails? Okay.
I don't think so.
Okay, so anyway, we're going to be starting by talking about quantum black holes and horizons. We're going to have three discussion sessions on quantum black holes and horizons. A thing that we're going to be emphasizing is the use of ideas from quantum information theory to understand the quantum geometries of black hole horizons. So that's going to be the topic tomorrow. But we're very happy to talk to any and all of you. There's a lot of good people in the group. So besides the faculty, we have a great group of postdocs. And we can really say, I mean, there are a few other good places in the world, but we can really say we're a leading center in the area. So if you're interested in knowing more, you're very welcome to talk to us. Even if you're not, whether you're interested in doing research in the area or not. Just if you just want to talk physics, we're very happy. So thank you very much.